I'm calling the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, January 29th, and let the record reflect that the time is 1:32 p.m. And today we have present Senator Wilson, Senator Michicki, Senator Keel, and myself, Chair Hughes. As you usually hear at the beginning of these committees, I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones or turn them off. And I'd also like to welcome and thank our staff that are going to be assisting with the Transportation Committee this session. With Senate Records, we have Carrie Cooper-Ryder. And with the LIO back in the corner, we have Flannery Ballard. And today is the inaugural committee for my new committee aide, Amy Bushnell, first time being committee aide. So let's all be easy on her today. I know she's going to do a fantastic job. We have one item on today's agenda, and a very important one, the consideration of the governor's appointment to the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, Mr. John McKinnon. So he will present some opening remarks, and once we've concluded with questions, we'll open public testimony. And if there are too many folks online for that, we will ask you to submit written testimony if we run out of time. And just for today, as well as throughout the committee, the testimony, public written testimony email is senate.transportation@kleg.gov. So you might want to make a note of that. So I'd like to at this time invite Commissioner Designee McKinnon to the table, please. Either one. So welcome, Mr. McKinnon. Please place your name on the record and begin your opening remarks. And before you begin, I'd like to let the record reflect that Senator Schauer has joined us.
Chair Hughes and members of the Senate Transportation, for the record, my name is John McKinnon. I'm the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Transportation. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present here today and also for the opportunity to serve the state of Alaska again. A little bit about myself. I was born here in Juneau in 1952. Gives you a little idea of what my age is. I graduated from high school here in 1970 and college from the Huxley College of Environmental Studies, part of Western Washington University. It was State College then. Did that in 1976. For a couple years after that, I was a biologist for the National Marine Fisheries Service at the Auk Bay Lab here in Juneau. That was from about 1975 to 1977, and from 77 to about 2001, I was a building contractor here in Juneau doing mostly commercial work, private commercial as well as government contracts. Around 2000, 1999 to 2000, I stopped enjoying being a contractor, and you know, if you don't enjoy what you do, you should stop doing it because, you know, life is so short, and you really want to you want to enjoy what you're doing. And so I attempted to retire in 2001 and did not succeed at that. I took a position as interim city manager in 2002, and in 2003, Governor Murkowski appointed me to be a deputy commissioner of transportation. And I did that from 2003 until 2008. I served with Governor Murkowski, or for Governor Murkowski and Governor Palin. And in about that time, in 2008, my last year at DOT, the Associated General Contractors of Alaska, made me an offer I couldn't refuse. It required moving to Anchorage to take the job. But, you know, it was a good organization. I'd worked with them at DOT, and I couldn't pass up the opportunity to take on that that role as executive director. Here I am, an opportunity. I was planning on retiring the end of December from AGC, and an opportunity came up with the new administration to come back to DOT. I'd like to add that going in 2008, going from AGC to DOT was not a difficult transition. A lot of the issues at DOT we dealt with in the construction industry at the Associated General Contractors. You know, it wasn't moving to the other side of the table. It was more like changing chairs or changing hats. We were dealing with construction issues, and one, I was wearing a hat at DOT, and the other one, I was wearing a hat at the contractors, but the issues were the same. It's how to improve what we do in the construction business. my time at AGC was spent mostly advocating for the industry and supporting construction and development projects, regulation changes that improve the way we do business, and statute changes, and also working with owner agencies on issues. We worked with the Corps of Engineers, DOT, DEC, Department of Labor, when there were issues and regulations they had that impacted the construction industry that could be improved to the benefit of both sides. We worked together and made improvements to those regulations, and also a number of statutes that we were able to develop. And I think over the period of time I was there, we had four law changes that improved both the way the construction industry worked, as well as working with some of the state agencies. I can't think of any accomplishments when I was at AGC that were at odds with what we do at DOT. We had regular meetings with DOT, a working group together where we discussed issues with specifications or operations and worked together to improve those and improve the working relationship between contractors and the department. And now coming back to DOT from AGC, it's a very similar transition. It's just moving to a different chair regarding the construction industry, because what the primary job that DOT does is we build and we maintain things to keep the transportation in Alaska moving. I've been in public service in a number of capacities, either appointed or elected, since 1983, and I get a tremendous amount of satisfaction from public service in that regard. And I take public service very seriously, those words, public service. And my philosophy with public service is how to get to yes when you're doing something. You know, what may have shaped my belief early on in that, you know, getting to yes was as a younger person, I went to government to get permission to do something, and I was told flat, no, you can't do that. And, you know, that I didn't like that answer, because what I wanted to do was fairly simple. But, you know, when government, the easy thing for them to do is say no. It takes work to say yes. And another time I was going to government, and I met somebody there that had a different answer. They said, well, you know, if you want to do that, here's what you need to do to get there. It was like how to get to yes, and I really appreciated that. It was, you know, it was refreshing to have somebody in a regulatory position tell me how to get what I needed to do, instead of just the simple answer of no. And so I've kind of believed that was the way the government officials do, is how do you help, how do you serve the public, the applicants, the public overall, in helping them to get yes. In DOT, you know, we do a lot of projects. We go to an extraordinary effort in public involvement, and sometimes the public suggests benefits and changes to these projects, which are good. And you know, I know that staff goes out of their way, in most cases, to try and accommodate the wishes and the needs of the public, but you can't always do that. Sometimes the needs of an individual or a group of individuals does not outweigh the greater public benefit of certain transportation improvements. But again, what I want to say is that my philosophy and practice at DOT will how to get yes and serve the public in that regard. So I'm available to answer whatever questions you might have, and hopefully I can answer those.
Committee members, do you have a question for Commissioner Designee McKinnon? Senator Wilson.
I'll start. Thank you, Mr. McKinnon. Basically, and I'll just try to get to the short of it, Mat-Su area, my district, has suffered great losses of not having the benefit of full benefit of DOT operations, maintaining our roads, building our roads, sort of negotiating some of the issues, especially now with the earthquake and some other issues and priorities. Basically, I just want to know, what will DOT do for the Mat-Su in terms of making sure, because there's no, I mean, for the past 4 years, and there's lots of records showing, you know, money's being moved around, other issues of sort of using the Mat-Su Valley and our roads as political leverage in the last administration. How will that not happen, or how will the equitable building up of capacities happen within DOT? Is it going to be safety improvements on our safety corridor that we have out there that many of folks have lost their lives on traveling? What will you do for the Mat-Su?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, You have a couple of major projects there that I know one of them, KGB Road, is probably the number one priority in Central Region. The next higher priority in Central Region is that next phase of the Parks Highway, takes it all the way to Big Lake. Both of those are difficult projects, and probably what makes them difficult is what is the disruption to the residents along the way and the business along the way. And when I came to DOT in 2003, that was when that first phase of the parks from the interchange up was being done, and experienced some of the problems, the difficulties with that. And the next phase, the challenges were the same. You've got businesses and people that have had direct access to a road. A road that needed to be improved and the capacity increased to meet the traffic demands. And in order to do those improvements, in most cases, they lose their direct access to the main highway. The driveway is gone. They end up having to access by a frontage road. And that's where the resistance comes in. And it's what they're experiencing now on the parks as well as KGB Road. That's really the crux of the problem, losing direct access. If you want to make a road safe, you limit the number of intersections, and if you put a lot of driveways on there, your safety improvements are going to be nothing. So that's the big problem there. I know I've met with Central Region people a couple of times, and you know, they've reiterated to me that those KGB Road is the highest priority project. It's going to be cut into a couple of phases because of the funding. One is a bond money, and then there's a federally funded project that is approaching $100 million in estimate, so they're probably going to break that into two pieces, not to delay it or anything, but break it into two pieces so that you generate a little more competition in the bidding. You know, projects that are large limit the number of bidders, and when you break it down to a smaller number, you get a little better competition and better better use of the public's money. I want to back on what we did do. I started on December 3rd, a couple days after the earthquake, and the first day I was on the job, Senators Murkowski and Sullivan were in the state and invited me along into a trip to visit a number of the damaged areas. And it was actually an incredible day. We flew around in a big helicopter for quite a bit. But we did sit down at Vine Road, and we visited Vine Road and you know, looked at the damage there. And the photographs of the damage were incredible. But the next day, I happened to be in the office in Central Region in Anchorage, and the borough manager, John Moosey, called up and asked if we could help them rebuild the road because they just didn't have the capability of doing it. And DOT is an organization that builds things. And without hesitation, I asked my folks. I said, "Can we do it? Yeah, I mean, can you throw some people at it and take care of it?" And there was, you know, we didn't worry about who was going to pay for it, how that was going to happen. It was like, we need to get the work done, go up there and take care of it. And within a couple of days, Vine Road was repaired and paved over. It's remarkable how you can pave and you know, when the weather's that cold and snowing. But they did an amazing job.
I just want to make the comment. I want to thank you for that response. And I also want to point out, this is our first Transportation Committee meeting, and it's about our designee. But I want to just mention, as the chair, I have lived all over this state. I have lived out in rural, in Bush, Alaska, where I've been dependent on the airports and aviation for transportation. I've lived in Southeast, where the ferry system had definitely had a role, and I still have family in the area. And now in South Central on the road system, actually I was in Fairbanks for a while too. So I have a good appreciation. I just want members to understand that of our system. But one thing I'm not sure people realize, the growth in Mat-Su, that I saw a number recently along KGB Road, which is a safety corridor, 19,000 plus people. That is two-thirds the population of Juneau, for instance. And so people need to understand it's just one two-lane road. And when we think here in Juneau of the Egan Drive, you know, we have a divided four-lane road. So just an understanding of why that need is so great, and It's been grievous to see the number of fatalities and serious injury along that route. So I appreciate your attentiveness to that. And since I mentioned Juneau, I just wanted to ask, because we're aware that you in the past have had some property that would go close to where the Juneau Access Road is. So I just like to hear from you what you're thinking in regard to that, anything as far as the governor's movement on that, and just how you will deal with that particular issue. And then also, we all know that funding for the ferries has been something that's been very tough pill to swallow, because the costs have risen. And what you're thinking as far as the ferry system, and I hope, Senator Keel, I didn't steal your thunder, but I am curious and just want to give you an opportunity to talk about Southeast.
Thank you. Chairman Hughes, the conflict of interest question has to do with the Kensington mine. There's a corporation, a business called Hayek Mining Company, that is largely held by myself, my brother, and other family members, and it owns the property where the Kensington mine was constructed. The ore body that has been mined until recently has been the Kensington ore body. They're in the process of mining some that belongs to Hayek Mining Company. When I joined DOT in 2003, March 7, 2003, when I did that, I resigned as a director and officer of Hayek Mining Company. I stayed away from the project, and at one point I sought an ethics opinion from the department's ethics attorney that said I should refrain from either withholding or making any decisions related to the project because there was a conflict of interest. I recently had that reaffirmed by the current ethics attorney for the state, for the department, and basically that's my position. I would recuse myself from any matter that would result in a either withholding or making a decision on that particular project, or, and actually it's been expanded, or something, any project that might reasonably benefit the Kensington Mine project. So those were the rules that I followed when I was here in 2003 to 2008, and those are the rules I'm following today.
Yes, a follow-up, Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Commissioner-elect McKinnon, thanks again for showing up today. Because you have held a vast experience in the state, especially under AGC more recently, it just made me think of are there any other areas that we would want to get on the public record that might be a conflict of interest that you have talked to ethics about regarding the position you have? Because obviously, like you said, this kind of blurs the lines a little bit between, you know, you're kind of just continuing in this construction business. So were there any other things that we would want to know about that have popped up that would, like I said, would be a matter of public record in that position as the AGC?
You know, I can't. The only thing that remotely might be is in my capacity at AGC, we negotiated contracts with six different building trade unions, and as part of that, I had the opportunity to be a trustee on the pension and health trust for the Carpenters Union for Alaska. I'm still a trustee on that. I've asked for whether that was an issue. We meet quarterly. I have not heard back if that was going to be a problem. I don't see it as one. Carpenters don't directly deal with it. The union don't directly deal with the Department of Transportation.
But your plan would be, if something was to come up, thank you, would be to just recuse yourself if any of these come up, if they pop up as an ethical issue.
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, yes, absolutely. I'm very sensitive about that. Obviously, it's, you know, when you read articles, in my wife in her previous capacity, bloggers like to take liberty with accusations and that sort of thing. Very sensitive about that. You know, I hold the public trust very important.
Thank you.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Mr. McKinnon. Thank you for all of your service to the state in the past, and both in the private and public sector. And we're all going to have our issues with DOT. We have this little place called Cooper Landing. You've been through it. We've got some rocks falling on people entering into my district there. So, but my questions are not related to that. I'm really more interested in your management philosophy of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. and changes you deem necessary to fulfill your mission. I mean, I was a supporter of the last commissioner, fine man. I'm glad you're here. Things change as administrations change. But what do you see as your biggest challenges on getting the department to more adequately fulfill its mission if you see that there are any gaps?
Through the chair, Senator Baczycki, I think the biggest challenge that I see coming up is one of staffing. The department has a lot of professionals, a lot of engineers and other transportation professionals, and like many other in many other industries, you know, we're facing this the baby boomers are leaving the industry, and we're also faced with a fair amount of turnover, somewhere between 10 and 12% annually. It's recruitment and retention of employees is a challenge. My philosophy in when I was at DOT before, as well as my time at AGC, is I like to invest in our employees. When it comes to professional development, I encourage it. I want DOT to have the best there is. I want, if they need training in certain areas, I'm going to encourage that to happen. And I want them to, and there's a quote I'm searching for it, something to do with, I want to train my and treat my employees so much that they'll be able to go work somewhere else but want to stay here. That's paraphrasing it, but when it comes to managing the three regions we have, I'm not going to micromanage. I didn't before. I like to know what the projects are. I'll ask questions why we're doing this. When somebody from the public comes and says, you know, I've asked the department why don't they do with this with the project, I'll take that question to the project managers and get answers. And you know, why isn't that request being accommodated? Usually a good reason for it. And we're dealing with one right now in an Anchorage project. But my goal is to hire professionals, good people, treat them well, and help them do their job as I can.
Follow up, Senator Baczycki.
So back on the, you know, kind of a statewide focus, and I could ask many questions about the Alaska Marine Highway System and other specific questions. Probably save that for the senator to my right, far right. We have some fairly significant funding challenges in the state of Alaska. The only capital budget has essentially been the federal, I mean, state dollars, bringing in a federal match on highway projects. How do you see that changing with a $1.6 billion budget gap, and how do you propose to manage that while still meeting transportation needs?
Well, through the chair, Senator Baczycki, there are things that I'm not at liberty to talk about because the Office of Management and Budget is handling that. And until the governor's budget is released on February 13th, we've been asked to keep certain things close. When it comes to the federal highway program, we're fortunate to get about $500 million a year from the Highway Trust Fund for our federal program, and that requires a roughly 10% match of state funds. That's incredible leverage. And I couldn't imagine a budget scenario where we would give up that kind of money for a 10% investment. If that was being proposed, you'd hear me screaming very loud. Very similar thing on the aviation side. Through the Airport Improvement Program, that number is about $200 million a year coming from federal government. I might add that. You know, that money is coming from another government, and it's their money that they let us spend, but we spend it according to their rules, and sometimes their rules aren't as easy as you would think. You know, an anecdote we had before when there was a little bit more money flowing in the capital budget is that a state dollar was worth a dollar, and a federal dollar, when it came to doing a project, was worth about 75 cents because of the strings attached to it. We have a lot more process spending a federal dollar than a state dollar. But nevertheless, you know, that kind of leverage, you know, 10 to 1 on dollars, it's really hard to say no to that.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I assure you didn't steal my thunder, but I'll follow up on your illuminating flash. With regard to, since everyone seems to think I'm going to ask a Marine Highway question, I wrote one on the spot. Commissioner Designee McKinnon, well, first of all, it's good to see you again. I think I first ran into you professionally when you were acting city manager here in Juneau, mm-hmm. Giving me answers I didn't like about what I could do with my garbage. that's all right. It's all right. You were following the rules. It's one of those things. So in the years I've worked on marine highway system issues, I think it's fair to say we've seen a number of different visions for the system and how it can be operated most efficiently and best serve Alaskans and the economy. When we make multi-million or $100 million decisions in vessels and in terminals, it would be good to have a vision that lasts a long time. Mm-hmm. So I know there are some proposals out there to change maybe how we reach our vision and how we structure the management at the top of the system. Be interested in your thoughts on how we can do the best job in long-term planning for our marine highway system and make sure that we've got a system that's going to work indefinitely.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Keel, you know, the plans for the marine highway system seem to change about every 4 years, maybe 6 or 8 years, but they go back and forth. And from my experience, the model that has worked very well is what we see in southern southeast Alaska with the Lituya, home ported in Metlakatla. The crew lives in Metlakatla. It makes twice daily runs, not 7 days a week, between Metlakatla and Ketchikan. It actually allows residents of Metlakatla to work in Ketchikan because of the frequency of runs. But it doesn't operate more than 12 hours a day, and the crew goes home every night. You know, that's a model that works. Labor costs on those ships when they're operating 24 hours a day are very high, and as you're probably aware, the labor cost is a portion of the whole budget is approaching 70%. That's even when the price of fuel is high, that's a high percentage for labor costs. That model of having smaller ships and home ported in areas is a model that could work, but it takes consistency with administrations in order to carry that through. The Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan, as I recall, has changed a number of times, and it goes from road segments and shuttle ferries to no road segments. We're going to have longer routes for the ships. It's hard to have a program when you know the wind direction keeps changing. So, you know, this administration is here for at least 4 years, and hopefully the wind direction won't change.
Thank you. We know that the administration has talked about Alaska being open for business, and I think it was former Governor Frank Murkowski coined the phrase roads to resources. And at the State of the State, the governor mentioned going even beyond oil and gas, even though that is the primary industry in our state, that he wants to see other doors open. That can mean infrastructure, and so it's not a catchy a phrase with the alliteration of the R's, roads to resources, so it's a clumsy one, but transportation infrastructure for economic development. And are there any projects, or are you and the administration thinking along those lines? For instance, it could be if we're looking at a new mine that we might need, rather than a road, an airstrip, or we might need some port development in order to move goods in and out. Are there any projects right now that are under consideration? Are you thinking along those lines? And if you aren't, I encourage you to.
Yeah. Chair Hughes, you know, the Roads to Resource program actually did a number of interesting little projects that resulted in access to timber sales, both in Gravina Island, out of Ketchikan, as well as some in the Mat-Su. There are projects on the books right now. The Ambler Road is one that was suspended, I believe, about 4 years ago, and I think a year or two ago the previous administration started it up again. It would access a number of potential mining properties in northwest Alaska. We have to be careful, though, when we get involved in those things, because a major development for a mine requires a fairly significant environmental document, an EIS, and it can complicate things if you have a couple players in there. I know that in the Donlin project back, 12, 14 years ago, DOT approached them and said, what can we do to help? And after we spent a few meetings, we discovered the best thing to do was just stay out of the way until they needed help. There have been projects where the state was involved. The Red Dog Mine Road, for example, was funded by ADA and is being paid back over the life of the mine through the use of the road. The potential for that in other areas is there. Whether DOT is directly involved in that, I can't tell you because we haven't been asked. But other potential mining projects, I mentioned Donlin, Pebble, it's, you know, we stay out of the way until we're asked because our participation can complicate NEPA.
Thank you. And just I'll follow up and then I'll call you, Senator Wilson. So I'm glad that DOT understands the importance of working with the private sector and stepping in at the right time. And speaking of private sector and business, we've seen news reports regarding Uber and Lyft at the Anchorage International Airport and concern that what might be proposed might be more than what's being charged taxi drivers for an annual fee. Can you speak to DOT's work on that matter and maybe answer questions the public might have?
Thank you. Chair Hughes, the airport is required to collect fees from anyone performing commercial activities in the airport. You pay for the operation of the airport through those fees, either rent or a concession or a fee of some sort. Cab drivers pay fees. And Uber and Lyft, there's a public comment period ongoing right now to charge Uber and Lyft, which they would pass on to whoever's taking the fare, $2.50 either to drop somebody off or pick somebody up there. There is a cost associated with those services at the airport. They spend much of their time in the cell phone lot a mile or two down the road, and we put in porta potties and litter barrels to accommodate them because those facilities weren't available there and they were needed. As far as the fee goes, we're having that internal discussion. The public comment is out there at $2.50. I did get from the aviation folks there a fairly large spreadsheet of fees that other airports charge. The goal in the whole thing is to make sure that we collect the fees because there is a cost of them using the airport. We have not actually arrived on what the actual fee will. It will not be. It cannot be more than $250. It will likely be a little less than that. But we're having internal discussions on that. On the long term, the number of people being dropped off and picked up at the airport because of airport activity is increasing, and we've got a lot of congestion there when flights get in, especially in the summer when traffic picks up. There will be a fairly large capital expense at some point in order to accommodate that. The cabs, the public, the buses, and the TNCs. So,
and are you seeking fairness between the TNCs and the taxis? Because is it correct the taxis are, is it 75 a year, 175 a year? I'm just thinking if it's 75, it would only take 30 trips that an Uber driver would meet that, and it's very conceivable that a Uber driver would come to the airport more than 30 times in a year, and I think that's the concern, fairness. So are you seeking fairness in that regard?
There's equity and there's parity in the whole thing, and yes, we're looking at that, and I will say that you know what we've discussed might not be agreeable with the airport folks, but we're having those conversations.
Senator Wilson.
Just to follow up on that same lineup that Senator Hughes had on both the previous questions, was there the equitableness of just like your rent fees in the airport? I know that one renter pays pennies on the dollars for the railroad, the facility. I mean, it was a couple hundred dollars a year that they pay for their facility to house there. So the leases aren't quite as equitable, and that similar comments on that. But just on your general philosophy on your the DOT's direction on the public partner private partnerships around the state, where do you see that heading? Do you see that increasing, decreasing, or just your general philosophy on sort of that the model and building new projects around the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I don't know if it falls directly into public-private partnerships in that regard, but the traditional model for construction in the state has been design, bid, build. The department or consultants do with the design for the project. You know, it's at 100% design. It goes out to bid, and the contractor submits a price that I will build what you've drawn and specified for this amount, and it goes to the low bidder. That's been the traditional way of doing things, but for quite a few years, we've achieved some success by going to different models, a best value model, and one of those used very frequently is design build. There have been some success stories with design build in the state. API was one of those, the Glen Parks Interchange, Whittier Tunnel, and that's where the contractor comes on very early, and you know, you've got a fixed dollar amount, and basically the contractor provides the design for the project, and after an evaluation process, you select the best value for the state in a design build. One that we've started using for quite a few years in the facility side for building construction, but starting to on the highway side, is called CMGC, or Construction Manager General Contractor. And that's when, through an RFP process, the most qualified contractor is selected to participate early on with the department and the designers on actually designing a project. And at the end of that design period, the contractor is under contract but doesn't have the construction contract, and you negotiate a guaranteed maximum price. And we've used it on three bridge projects. It's something the Federal Highway Administration has been promoting through one of their initiatives called Everyday Counts. It gets the project out sooner. But I think the beauty of the whole thing is, and I mentioned this earlier, when you negotiate the construction contract, you establish what's called the guaranteed maximum price. That's the guaranteed maximum it's going to cost the state to build that project. Whereas when you do a design bid build, where the contractor submits the lowest price to do it and is awarded a contract, that's usually the guaranteed minimum price that project's going to cost. Flaws in the design or unexpected quantity overruns and that result in more compensation to the contractor. So what is the number at bid time is usually the lowest number you see. It quite often goes considerably over that. When it comes to spending the public's money, it's really nice to know that you've got the guaranteed maximum price for that. It also takes advantage of the contractor's expertise in building it. So those people that design projects usually have never built anything, so they might be designing things that have constructability issues. And when you get the contractor involved early on, they can suggest techniques, design changes, a variety of things that can lower the cost and make it easier to build.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two, and one of them is just a real quick, almost a follow-up related to that with the earthquake and some of the buildings that we had a few issues, like in Eagle River and others. This isn't my primary question, but it just popped into my head here. I just had a group come through to talk about construction and state standards, so minimum standards for housing. Below a triplex, we don't really have one. Would you support or not, based on either government regulatory burden, et cetera, a change so that we would have a statewide building code for below the triplex and below? Because as I understand it, they briefed me that for a fourplex and up, there is a state code. Mm-hmm. But in essence, there isn't one below that. Do you think that's needed, and would you support it for a statewide building code?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, I've been dealt most of my life in dealing and working in municipalities, and most municipalities have adopted building codes. And those building codes have been adopted for single-family dwellings, too. I know here in Juneau and Anchorage, and at least the city of Fairbanks, they do have an adopted building code. So if, as far as the state goes, there's probably an issue that's going to come to you that when we did some, in the last few years, when there were some budget changes that occurred, they closed the fire marshal's office in Fairbanks and Juneau and consolidated that in Anchorage, and the net effect has been outside of organized boroughs with building departments, the time that it's taken to get plans approved to build something in, say, Dillingham or Bethel or Nome, for that matter, have taken a lot longer.
I'm going to interrupt for a second. Let's keep this on DOT. I know that that's an interest, yeah. But could you address that in regard to public facilities, since that does fall under you? Are the public facilities earthquake, the best they can be as far as earthquakes? And we'll just bring it back to DOT.
Through the chair, the new facilities we have are built to codes. And the codes have changed a lot over the last couple of decades. Every time there's an earthquake, we seem to discover something new. I know the last big one in California resulted in a lot of changes to bridge piers and that. My understanding is that the newer buildings are meet those code standards. The buildings that have had failures, the two schools in Eagle River, the one in Houston, they were built in the early 80s and a different set of codes. They may have been built to the code at that time, but the code at that time was not sufficient.
You have another question, Senator? Question. Your real question,
I do,
Senator
my real
Schauer.
Question. It did kind of tie in. I didn't do a good job, and Chair Hughes helped with that, but it's going to cost the state because there's aid programs and other things that happen and the relief effort, you know, for things that weren't built to maybe the appropriate standards. So my real question, a little bit contentious, and it does relate to the earthquake, and I relate a personal story. The day that we had the earthquake, my cardiologist called me from Matsu Regional, sitting at home because I was at home when it happened. And, of course, the bridges were all shut down, so they had a man having a heart attack they delivered to the hospital that was sitting there, and he had nowhere to move him because he had too many – they were full. They had several other things happening. And he knew I had an airplane. You know, and I'm just a couple miles from the hospital. And he's like, life flight is full. We can't get the patient to Anchorage. He's having a heart attack. He actually called me to go, Mike, can you come pick it? If we bring him to you, can you fly him into Anchorage? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, is Merrill open? I mean, land on the road? I mean, whatever. So I say that to go, obviously, we have reopened the issue of the transportation, the lack thereof, of an alternate route between Anchorage and the Matsu, our two primary population centers and economic engines. What are your thoughts on how we might move forward and should we, and kind of how we're kind of afraid to build things, either the bridge, you know, the Kubota Bridge, or an alternate method to get in and out of Anchorage, highway expansion, et cetera. Do you have thoughts and opinions on where and how we might move forward on that? Because clearly it's a problem.
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, I know that the legislature last year asked for a study to be done of that Glen Highway corridor and alternate route should that happen, and I believe it was supposed to have been delivered
tomorrow.
I mean, it's end of January, the 30th or 31st. And I know that one of your next meetings, we're going to be giving you a presentation on it. You know, there are alternate, I mean, for the Glen Highway corridor, if we have another event like the bridge event last spring, we can handle the connectivity. It's just the volume of traffic that's the challenge. We had the same thing after the earthquake. We had that stretch of the southbound lane at Mirror Lake closed for 4 or 5 days. And there was bypass on that, and that worked very well, but it just could not handle the volume of traffic. That's where we're talking 40, 50,000 cars a day on that corridor. It takes at least 4 lanes to handle that.
So. Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe to play off some of what you talked about, the other great success you department had with CMGC was the State Library Archive Museum.
Yes.
Here in Juneau, which
Senator Keel, the acronym stands for
Construction Manager General Contractor.
Thank you.
That the commissioner doesn't need to find a minute ago, and I think if memory serves, the construction manager folks in your public facility section brought that at about $7.5 million under budget. So, kudos to that one. It brings me to a question about the public facility section and the approach over the years. I think we have seen a shift to the public facilities folks in your department building them,
mm-hmm.
and other folks managing them. And I wonder, do you have an opinion about whether that's the best approach? Would we be better off to have public facilities built and managed by the same folks? Is there a more efficient or a more effective way to do it than we're doing today?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. I believe in 2015 that there was a change made from instead of having different entities in the state control certain buildings. I know the Department of Administration had their own public building fund and had a number of buildings under their jurisdiction. And I believe in 2015 the shift was made back to create the Division of Facility Services within DOT, and over a period of time those other public buildings would migrate back in there, and one entity would manage the maintenance and operation and, quote, the leasing of those. And the way that has worked is that they look at the operating cost for a facility, and in the initial setup, they look at the operating cost of that facility over a three-year period and come up with an average of this is the rent that you need to pay for that year, and that particular department or entity pays the Division of Facility Services that amount to operate. So what you're suggesting actually is happening. Do I think that's a good idea? So far it's worked. I know there were problems when different entities had different management of their facilities. In statute, the Department of Transportation is responsible for the construction of all of that stuff in the state, and they have delegated some of it at certain times and certain instances. But for the most part, I think that the model that was created a few years ago is working. We got briefed by DFS a few weeks ago, and there was nothing there that raised a red flag in my mind. So,
just to follow up.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, is it helping us get any kind of a handle on the deferred maintenance issues that we have on state facilities?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, it's giving us an idea of what the deferred maintenance needs are. There just hasn't been any funding to take care of it. And I, you know, I've been a firm believer in keeping up with the deferred maintenance, because the failure to keep up with those things, it doesn't just increase by a few percent every year. It compounds. And we're getting woefully behind on things.
Thank you.
Senator Michiki.
Thank you. Mr. McKinnon, part of managing deferred maintenance is also a surplus asset disposal plan, which the state has never really practiced. We seem to gather real estate and buildings and equipment. I understand equipment gets processed, but I have two questions. The first is, do you foresee a comprehensive plan on sort of a evaluation of what we've gathered and what we actually need to do our business every day, and is there potential for the state to dispose of some of those surplus assets?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, I know that's one of the initiatives that we've talked with O&B about, is there are a number of assets that we have, there is a potential to dispose of some of those. An example is that we have our civil rights office, our facilities section, and at least one other section are on this building off of Tudor Road. It's got to be at least 45 years old. It was a nursing home at one time. I don't recall how DOT acquired it, but we acquired it. One wing of it actually has been, for all practical purposes, condemned as a result of the earthquake, because in the earthquake it separated a little bit from the rest of the building, and we have not gone back in and occupied it. And I want to fast forward to something else with the BRAC that occurred a while ago, where QLIS moved off of the Anchorage Airport property to J-Bear. They, of course, deeded to the airport a tremendous amount of property there, a large old hangar, but a bunch of other buildings that are in fairly good shape, and a couple of those aren't immediately available for aviation purposes. And one of the rules that when you've got property on the airport, that everything has to have some kind of an aviation purpose, and so when you start having things not related to aviation, it's frowned upon by the FAA, and again, the FAA is one of our funding partners, and we try and keep them happy. We're looking at a couple of the buildings on the old QLIS property and they were office buildings when the guard had them, and get them back into use as office buildings. I know one of the buildings with a hangar is in the process of being sold to one of the operators there. A couple are being leased, and I don't know if you've heard about Rotac Helicopters, a new business in the state. They've got a couple of these heavy lift helicopters. They actually building a facility on the QLIS property. Probably a long answer to the question. We are looking at where we can dispose of things and where we can make other use of those things.
One more follow-up?
Follow-up, Senator Michiki.
So the chair sort of touched on it, but when I had the DOT budget in the past, I tried to sort of streamline turn it back into a triangle instead of a bell. Management has a tendency to move up and you know, the shape that it develops and the cost that's associated with it. The question I'm going to ask is, privatization does not always work. But we have a shift in Alaska when things are booming in the construction industry and is paying well, we have a tendency to lose some of our best employees to the industry, and then some of them come back when things are going. Is there a way to evaluate privatization so that we take advantage of both worlds, so that where some of the services are privatized, yet you could sort of eliminate some of that shift while still streamlining your department somewhat significantly?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I want to focus on that part of DOT to answer your question. That part of DOT that actually does the construction project, spends the federal highway money, and there's the design section, or called pre-construction, and then there's that other part called construction and design. About 50% of the design that we do for our project is done in-house by DOT engineers and designers, and 50% is contracted out to a variety of consultants throughout the state, and it's done on availability basis. If we have the capacity in-house to take on a design project and get that project ready to go to construction, it's done in-house. But when opportunities come up with more money, then we contract those out, and they found over the years that somewhere between 40% and 60% of in-house, or the same number, contracted out, works very well. There's also the requirement when the project goes to construction, we're not allowed to just give that to a consultant and say, here, you go get it built with the contractor. Federal requirements of spending their money say that there has to be a DOT person in charge of that project and overseeing certain aspects of it. The consultant cannot make certain decisions on the project. Those decisions have to be relayed up the ladder to the DOT person to actually make the decision or okay it. It's kind of a cumbersome thing, but we do look at contracting those things out and do it where it's a benefit to both sides. I hope that answered your question.
It does, for Madam Chair. I actually have a series of questions on that issue that I will work with the chair and get them to you. I just want to make sure that we're evaluating all of the potential for bringing the cost down.
And before I move on to Senator Schauer, who's next, it piqued my interest. So sometimes you contract out. Is it pretty even, Stephen, as far as having the design done in-house versus outside, or is one more economical than the other?
Senator Hughes, it depends on you know, what else is going on in the department and what the resources available are. When I say 40% to 60%, that's a number it fluctuates between the low on 40 and the high on 60. And obviously, when it's 40 in-house, it's 60 contracted out, and vice versa. And it also depends on the region. Northern region has a lot more assets available to take on those projects themselves. Central region, a much bigger program. Sometimes the projects are much more challenging. Cooper Landing, for example, the longest EIS in history. They got a record of decision last summer. Amazing. Now we just got to figure out how quickly we can get that project built. So it's to say there's an exact number, there isn't. It's important that the department have those in-house capabilities, but we take advantage of consultants that when there is more work to be done, we give it to them. That was especially helpful in 2009 with the Recovery Act, American Recovery Act, the stimulus funds. Big chunk of money came to the state, $200 million, and we needed consultants to help get those projects ready to bid. Shovel ready doesn't really mean it's shovel ready, but it's close to going, and it needed a lot of finish work. So we took advantage and used that outside resource to get those projects going, and we're lucky to be able to spend all that money.
Well, thank you for that, and hopefully with the Transportation Finance Subcommittee Chair's permission, we could continue that conversation, because it sounds like it's project and region dependent, and I would hope that part of it would be that you're evaluating which is most economical for the particular project and region, whether in-house or done outside. So Senator Schauer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner-elect, so back to the earthquake just a little bit.
Go ahead.
Oh, scared me. The port, obviously, there was a little bit of damage, but there's general repairs taking place. And so there's a part that DOT plays in some of it and some not. But the number that just came out, I'm sure you saw that release, I believe it was $2 billion, was probably collectively the state gasped when they heard that number. And, of course, we have to get the numbers out that the port's important because most of our durable goods comes in every week through that port. Without it, we're in big trouble. So, and you have Port McKenzie across the way, and you don't necessarily need to tap on that unless you think it's germane to the discussion. But I'm curious on your thoughts about where we sit with that, what needs to happen strategically to make sure that this port is repaired appropriately and the way forward, because clearly for us this is a very important piece of our critical infrastructure.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Chauer, I wish we had some involvement in it, but it is owned by the municipality of Anchorage, and they're very they can be very possessive and territorial about what is theirs and what is not. One of the other responsibilities I have is also to be on the board of directors of the Railroad Corporation, and I met with the chairman of the board, John Cook, and Bill O'Leary this morning, and it kind of brought me up to speed on a number of issues that they're dealing with, and they're acutely aware of the very issue you're bringing up, the vulnerability of the port, and what do we do? The railroad's got a facility in Whittier, they've got a facility in Seward, both viable alternate ports for Anchorage, connected by both road and railroad to Anchorage. And like you said, 80% of the goods entering the state come in from the port. And I could imagine a scenario where we had another little shaker and there was some damage done to the port where it was out of use for a couple of weeks, couple of months. You know, repairing a project like that, you know, it's not a matter of just getting some dirt from a pit and putting some pavement on it. You're talking steel piling and some things that have some long lead items. So repairs to a damaged port could take a lot longer, and we would be, you know, after about 10 days, I think our grocery store shelves would get pretty bare. You would see alternate use of both Seward and Whittier, but they both require a tremendous investment, and of course, Point McKenzie. It's not built yet to take that kind of freight. It's been designed for conveyors to load chips and other resources like that, natural resources onto the ship. So we would be in a heap of hurt if there was an event that caused the Port of Anchorage to go out of commission for a while. We really would be.
Senator Chauer, and we're going to wrap this up just because we need to go into public testimony, and I just will mention that we are exploring maybe having a hearing on that topic. So. And then if anyone has any other questions after Senator Chauer's follow-up, you can submit them in writing, and we'll get them to the commissioner designee. Senator Chauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not really a question per se, Commissioner. It's more of just a follow-up. I wanted to get that on the record because that is a highlight of our critical infrastructure. And the reason I brought it up that way and said what you can control, what you can't with Anchorage and the port, is that we are thinking about what happens when we have that event, because I want to know in the public to understand and be assured that we are looking at those alternative methods to still bring supplies into the state via the road system, the railroad, with those other ports, because we can't forget about them. The infrastructure and making sure that we are taking care of Whittier, Seward, et cetera, that we have that alternate plan, that could be very critical for us, and I mean survival. So I just really wanted to get that on the record.
Yeah, thanks. And through the chair, Senator Chauer, believe me, that was the topic of conversation with the railroad this morning, is that if we had an event, you would see trucks coming up the highway with all of those goods. You would see the port of Whittier being used. You'd see Seward being used. Barges would still be able to come into Anchorage, not the big ships that come in. And I think you'd also see 747s and 777s coming into the airport, offloading there. It would not make the goods any cheaper than they are now. In fact, it would considerably add to the cost, but at least we'd have food on the grocery store shelves.
So. Yes, and I'll just say, in addition to exploring the port in that situation, we are going to be having a hearing in regard to the earthquake and how that really brought to our attention the problem with closures and disruptions. And my understanding is we only have about a 7-day supply on our shelves. So these are of serious concern. But I, at this time, again, submit questions if you have any more, and we're going to open public testimony. And I don't see anyone online. So no one online. Thank you, Flannery. And is anyone in the room, and anyone in the room like to testify? Going once? Oh, yes, we do. So, Commissioner, if you'd step away from the table. Please come forward and take a seat, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Ken McCarty from Eagle River. And the concern is shared there is from the earthquake, and I was down in, let me back up, sorry, that I'm the president of the Birchwood Airport Association. So we have a great airport there and very active. And I was out of the country when the earthquake took place, so I missed out on all of this. But the first question I asked for my colleagues there at the airport is, how safe is it? Is there any crack in the runway? Because if the roads are damaged, if there's bridges are gone, we would be the center for supplies, as Senator Showers made comment to that. So with the concern there and talking to a number of people in DOT and looking at volunteer programs, aviation in Alaska, strong, you know, emphasis to aviation not to be forgotten of in DOT with our general aviation and such. So that's my comment.
Thank you very much, Mr. McCarty. We appreciate you stepping forward. Is there anyone else in the room who'd like to testify? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. And I am going to read the official statement. So we all are aware of what we're doing here as we take the next step in this process now that we've had a chance to hear from Commissioner Designee McKinnon. In accordance with AS 39.05.080, the Senate Transportation Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Commissioner, Department of Transportation, John McKinnon. And this does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. So I also want to say that for the public, because there has been a little bit of confusion, when we take the step, and as I just read, we're signing, it's not a vote at this point. The vetting continues for all the commissioner designees all the way up until the joint chamber and we vote on the floor. So I just want to mention that the vetting continues for all the commissioner designees, including this one. So we wish you the best, commissioner designee, as you move forward. And that concludes our business today. So our next meeting will be the 31st. That is Thursday at 1:30 here in this room, for a presentation on the Glen Highway Integrated Corridor Management Study by Deputy Commissioner Mary Sirocki. And just so you know what that is, that actually stems from a request that I had a few years ago. I've been calling it the Traffic Diversion Plan. It's basically what happens if there's an incident with causing a full closure, partial closure, at any point between mile 0 and 35, what is the plan? And so that we can shrink the delays, and sometimes we've had 8 hour or more for a simple accident or something to that effect. So that's what that's going to be about. I know many members of the public are very interested in that, so I just want to make clear, sometimes those big long titles, we don't really know what it's about. So seeing no other business before the committee, we'll adjourn, and please, before you leave, sign the paperwork. Did you have another comment, Senator Michicki?
I did have a brief one.
Please. Please.
Just before we close out, we've had some comments about the earthquake, and I just want, for Alaskans that are watching, in case they think that we've suddenly become surprised and we haven't been planning for such things, that we have the Alaska Partnership for Infrastructure Protection, all the LEPCs, the munis, boroughs, and state have emergency contingency plans. It's always good to dust those off. They're in conjunction with DOD and the Coast Guard, police, fire, emergency managers. Those plans are in place. But there is always—it's always healthy to dust them off when we get a reminder like the earthquake. So we're not flat-footed, but we always have more work to do.
Absolutely, thank you for that added comment. It is, after an incident, it's always good to debrief and see how we can improve in the future. So we will adjourn now and let the record reflect. The time is 2:35.